Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. You know, one of the things you quickly realize when you start having conversations in a slightly more formal way is that the typical 30-second summary of a guest's professional life is usually inadequate. Today, though, I have run into that fact more obviously than ever before. My guest today is someone I admire immensely. Dr. Nicholas Christakis is, and has been, a medical doctor, a world-renowned sociologist, a best-selling author, and the director of the Human Nature Lab at Yale, where he is a sterling professor of social and natural sciences. He's just written his fourth book, entitled Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live, which, aside from being excellent, is also extremely well-timed. Dr. Christakis, thank you for coming on. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Jamie, thank you so much for having me. Please, of course, call me Nicholas, but yes, it's nice to speak to you.
Well, Nicholas, how are you getting on in these strangest of times?
I mean, you know, like everyone else, I suppose, or everyone else that's behaving well, you know, I only leave the house when I have to, and I haven't left the house much since March. I'm lucky to have a job that I can do from home. So, you know, we're sort of hunkered down here. We live in a rural part of a rural state called Vermont in the United States. So, you know, since March the 5th, I've left the house once a week, basically. But it's been productive, you know, because I have very few distractions and there's not much else to do. So I've been doing a lot of science for the last year. And yeah, I'm running my lab still at Yale. You know, we have mostly a dry lab that does computational work, and we have a small wet lab, and the wet lab people are going in periodically as needed, but everyone else is at home, all the young people, and of course me, and then I'm sort of running things remotely.
How's that been for you, running things remotely?
Well, it's not as good, of course, as seeing people face to face. It's especially difficult for recent additions or new additions to the lab. You know, when the music stopped and everyone had to start working from home, people who had established working relationships, it wasn't so hard. But think about the challenges in onboarding someone, you know, having a new student join your lab or a new employee when they've had no face-to-face interactions. It's very odd. I mean, this whole way of interacting is very odd. Like many other people, perhaps yourself included, I found it's much harder to do Zoom where you have the video link in ironically than just on the phone, but partly because, you know, you can see yourself oftentimes, and that's not a natural thing to see yourself while you're having a social interaction. And partly because there's a disjuncture between, you know, when you're physically present with someone, you can read them better. And now with this video interaction, it's harder. So anyway, so it's fine. You know, I'm running the lab remotely.
Well, I'm glad you're cracking on with it. It's clearly a difficult adjustment for everyone. But on the cutting edge of science, particularly these onboarding processes, et cetera, I imagine matter. Listen, there's so much to talk about, and I want to cover a fair bit of it. But before any of that, I just very briefly want to go to the start. I read that your parents both were at Yale as graduate students, and that's obviously now where you teach. Is that where they met? Was there a lot of Yale around growing up?
No, what my parents were Greek immigrants. They came in the late 1950s from Greece to the United States. They were both scientists. My father trained in nuclear physics. Actually, first he went to Princeton. Einstein had just died. He trained with Archibald Wheeler, the Nobel laureate, the famous physicist. Then went to Yale to get his PhD. And my mother had come from Greece and actually got a scholarship, went to Vassar. And then she also went to Yale to study physical chemistry. And they had met in college, you know, through the immigrant Greek community. They were set up. But then they were graduate students at Yale, and you know, I was born there, in fact. But then they went to Greece immediately. They got their degrees, they returned to Greece, and the first part of my life was in Greece.
Right, so the halls of Yale weren't ringing in your ears on any regular basis?
No, not necessarily. No, I mean, obviously, it's a famous institution. I mean, I was aware of it. And I did go to college there, in fairness. You know, when I was 18, I returned to New Haven as an undergraduate student. And then I returned as a professor. After Yale, I went to Harvard Medical School. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania to get a PhD in sociology. Then I went to the University of Chicago as an assistant professor. Then I went to Harvard as a full professor. And then I was at Harvard from 2001 to 2013. And then I returned to Yale, you know, many years later.
Yeah, post all of that. Well, listen, to fast forward slightly, as you say, you trained as a doctor at Harvard Medical School. And a number of years on, your dissertation was adapted into your first book. So this is Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care. Now, something that struck me about the book was the idea that doctors are socialized to avoid making prognoses. And the prognoses that the patients do receive are driven by all sorts of things that have nothing to do with medicine and data itself. I mean, what might surprise people who assume that doctors and their prognoses are driven entirely by science?
Well, if you think about the three canonical cognitive functions of a doctor, diagnosis, prognosis, and therapy, prognosis is the sort of the thing that's left out. Doctors, of course, have non-cognitive things they're supposed to do, And they do, you know, emotional connection to the patient, support of the patient, and so on. But there was a time, you know, thousands of years ago during the time of Hippocrates, when doctors didn't have much they could do therapeutically about conditions and knew this. And therefore, one of their primary functions was prognosis. The patient would come, the doctor would make a diagnosis, like what's wrong, and then they would predict for the patient what would happen. They would offer prescriptions, but they kind of saw predicting the outcome as equally important. And that kind of emphasis on that skill was lost, especially actually, I would say, in the last 100 years, when doctors progressively acquired effective therapeutic powers. So as they came more and more able to show practical mastery over illness, the kind of prophetic mastery was abandoned. You know, I could show that I was competent in caring for you by properly diagnosing you and recommending treatment that was sort of scientifically grounded, and then I didn't really have to predict what was going to happen. It wasn't something I needed to do. And so that was a macro change in the role of prognosis. But one of the arguments I make in that book is that this is wrong in the sense that prognosis is very important. It's very important to patients. It's very important actually to the practice of medicine, being able to predict what's going to happen. And furthermore, I analyzed and showed the ways in which the prognosis is guided still by certain kind of quasi-magical, sometimes even religious sensibilities. Like many doctors, when I asked them, why don't you make predictions? They would say, well, that's for God to do. You know, they would give almost a religious response. Other doctors would articulate beliefs, for example, in self-fulfilling prophecy. Like they don't want to articulate their expectation that the patient will do poorly for fear that will accelerate the demise, let's say, of the patient. So there's a lot going on there with why doctors don't want to do it.
And is that fair, the self-fulfilling prophecy? Because I think there's this idea that like that's the type of placebo that, you know, may well stand up. Is that kind of what you found?
Well, this is the problem as well, is that there's some truth to that concern. A placebo effect is real. And so it is quite possibly the case that predictions, whether good or bad, can actually influence the course of illness. And I do discuss that too in the book, but in that old book now, that book was from 1999. So you're kind of challenging me to remember some of the details.
Yeah, sorry about
21
that.
Years ago. No, it's okay. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, there's been an explosion in placebo research in the last, even in the last 5 years, let alone the last 10 years, you know, documenting the truth to placebos and framing effects, you know, how people's expectations influence, you know, their actions and their experiences. But I don't think that's enough to suggest that we should lie to patients, nor are these effects sufficiently powerful that they're determinative in the sense that, you know, if you are dying of metastatic cancer, you know, my telling you that everything is fine, it's a lie and it's going to offer you no benefit. Remember, I was a hospice doctor, so the circumstances I was facing with prognosis were not things like the common cold. In fact, there was a famous study in which patients came to the emergency room. I may garble the details. It's been so long since I looked at it, but the gist was they were randomly assigned to have doctors basically sugarcoat the trajectory of the disease. So all the patients had a upper respiratory infection. Some were told, you know, these symptoms are going to be pretty benign and are going to remit in a couple of days. And those patients randomly assigned to get a more benign prognosis fared better. They used fewer tissues when they blew their nose. They subjectively reported fewer symptoms. So there was some truth in a sense to this self-fulfilling prophecy.
Very interesting. I guess that's where it's interesting scientifically too. And where ideas can be dangerous is when there's a little bit of truth in them, so they become easy to subscribe to. To go from one book in 1999 to one from just a few months ago, you've obviously just written and published Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. And in it, I really liked this. You quoted Albert Camus, who wrote that every war and every tragedy feels like a surprise, even when, looking at history, they're inevitable. Why is it that pandemics fit so neatly into Camus' description?
Of course, Camus was writing a book called The Plague, and you know he was making the same observation. You know, I think this experience that many of us are having around the world, let's keep in mind, not everyone. There are other parts of the world and other groups of people for whom infectious outbreaks are a more regular part of their lives. But it's true that for many hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, this way we have of living right now seems very unnatural and alien. But it's very important to remember that plagues are not new to our species. They're just new to us. I mean, we think this is crazy and outrageous, but it's not. I mean, plagues are an ancient threat. They're in the Bible. They're at the opening scene of Homer's Iliad, you know, one of the canonical works of the Western canon. They're in Shakespeare. They're in Cervantes. I mean, you know, plagues are a part of human experience. And as is, incidentally, that sense of shock when they come. you know, we're not the first ones to want to engage in denial during a time of plague. I mean, denial is almost a feature of plague, denial and lies. I mean, you know, for thousands of years, when plagues have come, people have lied about them. Part of the agenda of the book was to help people to come to grips with what was happening to us and to put it in some perspective so that people could act in a more self-protective and socially responsible way.
And has that been happening, in your view, en masse in the United States?
Well, no, I don't think anyone looking at the American response to the pandemic, we think we've done a good job. I mean, we've done an awful job. I'm ashamed of how we've done. And I think we are, you know, on a course. COVID-19 is going to be the second worst respiratory pandemic we've had in 100 years globally, second only to the 1918 Spanish influenza. So this is a serious event that's happened. It's a once in a century event that has happened to us. And in the United States, before the epidemic is over, I think we'll have lost at least 500,000 Americans, many as a million. This will be the leading cause of death on an annualized basis in our country. And a paper was recently written by Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, and a colleague of his, David Cutler, that called this the $16 trillion virus. They estimate that this virus did $8 trillion of economic damage to our country and $8 trillion in health damage in terms of death, disability, and illness. So this is a cataclysm. These are vast sums of money. And a once-in-a-century type, you know, event that has happened to us, yes.
Yeah, for perspective, American GDP, or at least American annual spending, is like $3 trillion, right? So you're looking at the equivalent of years' yes. worth of damage.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's like a Great Depression damage. I mean, this is a catastrophe, yes. And it may not feel that way to everyone yet or right now. And I think that's part of it. It's sort of difficult, you see, because many parts of life remain normal. As we all learned in high school mathematics, you know, there's a long flat part of the exponential curve, and then there's this inflection, and then it's sort of yeah. your steep ascent of the curve. But for a very long time, it looks like nothing is happening. You know, 1 becomes 2, becomes 4, becomes 8, becomes 16, becomes 32, becomes 61. It's not so much is happening. And then, you know, it just starts skyrocketing, and that's what happens.
I mean, it just explodes, right? That's the nature. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so the reason that poses a problem for public health management is it's very difficult to persuade people that something serious is happening because they look around and they don't see anything happening, right? You tell them, you know, there's exponential growth in the pathogen and the pathogen is going to double and double and double every week. And this is awful. And we need to get ready because 4 weeks from now, the hospitals will be collapsing. And people look around and they're like, well, life looks like normal to me. And in a way, the fact that this pathogen was not deadlier, I mean, of course, it's great that the pathogen isn't deadlier. I mean, SARS-CoV-2 kills about 1% of people who get it and get symptoms from it, which is really bad. I mean, that's a deadly germ. But it's not bad enough that people have the fear of God in them, right? It's not like the bubonic plague or like smallpox. And so in a way, people can kind of minimize it and not take it so seriously. And so this is another thing. There's also another subtle thing, independent of the middling mortality rate, the middling lethality of this germ. So it's 10 times deadlier than the flu, but it's much less deadly than cholera, you know, or yellow fever or something, is that the germ is capable of protean manifestations. So let me give you two examples. Let's say you could be in two different worlds. I'm going to ask you a question, okay? You could be in two different worlds. You could be in a world where there are 1,000 people. 10 of them get infected with a virus and they get seriously ill and one of them dies. So 10% of the people who get infected die. That's world A, okay? Sure. In world B, there are 1,000 people. 100 people get infected with a virus. 90 of them have a mild condition. 10 of them get seriously ill, just like in world A, and one of them dies. So 1% of all the people who got infected died in world B. Which of those two worlds would you rather be in, world A or world B?
Well, like from a utilitarian perspective, the death percentage is the same in both cases, but you just have less suffering in world A, so you would be tempted to choose world A.
Correct. And the death percentage actually is computed to be different. It depends over what denominator. So in world A, 1 out of 10 infected people died. In world B, 1 out of 100 infected people died. So it falsely seems less deadly in world B. But actually, in both cases, 1 out of 1,000 people died. And world B, in which the virus is capable not only of killing you, but also of making you mildly ill, falsely seems like a better world to be in. But it's not, in fact. And unfortunately, that is what SARS-CoV-2 is like. If it only caused serious illness and death, and the same number of them, but didn't also cause no symptoms or mild symptoms, ironically, we would be taking it more seriously. So this virus is a very sneaky virus. It has certain features, the middling mortality rate, plus the protean manifestations that make it a challenge to manage from a public health point of view.
Injustice is this idea that the thing that deters behavior is the likelihood that you get caught, not how strong the punishment is.
That's right. It's certainty of punishment, not magnitude of punishment, that's an effective deterrent. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that context, this makes a lot of sense. I mean, imagine if we walked around and you thought, God, you get this disease, that's you. You know, you could die, really, whoever yes. you are. Well, you'd go in your head, I guess the psychology would be, get virus, die, rather than get virus, oh, what's the fuss about? I mean, one thing you probably wouldn't have to the same degree is the politicization, which says vaccines are terrible or masks are terrible, yes. etc.
Why masks became politicized in the United States, other countries didn't politicize masks. You know, they just saw them as a physical barrier to droplets. In our country, in the United States, they became symbols either of your virtue, you know, your social consciousness, or of your commitment to freedom and liberty, which both of which are nuts. You know, like, I mean, I just think, you know, you wear a mask because it's a sensible thing to do during a respiratory pandemic. So, yeah, so there was a lot of politicization. I like your analogy very much to the certainty versus magnitude of punishment issue, which is, has been long described.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's funny. It's like that's America through and through, isn't it? The yes. fact that it's either a demonstration of your absolute virtue and the fact that you're on cutting edge of community morality and ethics. And on the other hand, it's a libertarian premise that you're going to defend and protect very nobly. Yes. So on a slightly more optimistic note, vaccines are beginning to be approved and rolled out. Now, having read the book, this raises two questions. The first is this. How have pandemics traditionally, typically ended, historically speaking? Because they haven't been with the vaccine for the most part.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we are the first generation of human beings whose time in the crucible facing a pandemic has coincided with the ability to develop a specific pharmaceutical countermeasure in real time. It's a miracle that we have invented several vaccines, you know, in 10 months and tested them and shown that they work. And we are very lucky that our time facing this ancient threat is at a moment when we can do this, when we can invent vaccines. Having said that, I think that it's worth, as you mentioned, highlighting a little bit of like what has typically happened with historical plagues. There's actually some interesting wrinkles with bubonic plague, because in bubonic plague, there were other actors. In this plague, you know, there's humans and the virus. In bubonic plague, there were two other actors, the fleas and the rats, and the humans and the Yersinia pestis. There were four actors there, which makes things a bit more complicated. But let me just limit myself to answering your question in the situation in which you have like a host pathogen type of situation. So typically what happens is there's something known as the R-naught, the R-sub-zero of a pathogen. That's its intrinsic infectiousness. It's called the basic reproduction number. It's the number of new cases you get for every existing case in a host population that is interacting normally and that has no immunity. It says, okay, how intrinsically able is this pathogen to spread? Now, and the most infectious pathogen that's known is actually measles, and that has an R-naught of like 16 or 18. So for every case, you get 16 or 18 new cases. It's really infectious. And then the seasonal flu has an R-naught, let's say, of 1.5. For every case of the flu, you get 1.5 new cases. It barely reproduces itself. It makes a little bit more, half an extra person each time there's transmission. The R-naught for SARS-CoV-2 is in between the two. It's between 2.5 and 3.5. So it's about 3, let's say, for the sake of argument. That's actually quite infectious as a pathogen. That's nothing to sneeze at. So this, as now we've now established that this pathogen has middling lethality, about 1% of people who get it and get symptoms die, and sort of intermediate infectiousness. Now, herd immunity is the idea that a population of people can be immune to a condition, even if not everyone within the population is immune. For example, if you vaccinate 96% of people against measles, if one of the 4% non-immune unvaccinated people gets a case of measles, you don't get an outbreak because there's nobody for them to interact with to spread it to. Most of the people are immune. And you can compute that herd immunity threshold by a simple mathematical formula, which is R-naught minus 0 over R-naught. So for example, in the case of measles, it's, let's say, 18 minus 1 divided by 18. It's a number like 96% or something like that. And that's why the vaccination threshold for measles needs to be so high. You need to have 96% of the people vaccinated. When the rate drops, for example, with anti-vaxxers in Southern California, then you get outbreaks as soon as the percentage drops to 92% or something like that. Now, for SARS-CoV-2, we said the R-naught was 3. So 3 minus 1 divided by 3 is 2/3. So about 67% of people need to be vaccinated in order to have herd immunity. But it turns out, for certain network science reasons we can talk about if you want, having to do with variation and how many social connections people have, actually that number is lower. It's about 50%. So roughly speaking, the herd immunity threshold for SARS-CoV-2 is 50%. So what's going to happen is the following thing. What happens is the virus or the pathogen spreads and spreads and spreads. And when you reach the herd immunity threshold, the virus is still present. It can still cause cases, but the epidemic force of the pathogen has been nullified. That was like the measles example I gave. Yes, you can have a case, but it doesn't cause an outbreak because just enough people, the herd immunity percentage, has acquired immunity that the epidemic force of the virus has been nullified. And this was the typical end of epidemics throughout history. Now, there's a lot else that can go on, and actually that's discussed in Apollo Zero in the last chapter, including that the virus typically, over long periods of time, mutates to get more benign because the pathogen doesn't want, quote-unquote, to kill us. It's better for us if it doesn't kill us rapidly and that we don't die so that, you know, we're not that sick. So we move around and we spread it. That's what, from the virus's point of view, it would prefer, quote-unquote, to do. Not just viruses. This also applies to bacteria. So there are a number of ways in which historically epidemics have ended. Reaching herd immunity is one of them. So in the current situation, here's what's going to happen. We've now successfully invented a vaccine, but we still have the challenges of manufacturing hundreds of millions of doses, distributing those doses, and most importantly, persuading people to take the vaccine. And we have to at least get to 50% of people being vaccinated, like we were talking about the herd immunity threshold. And all of that, I think, is going to take about a year, end of 2021, roughly speaking, before we get to this crucial threshold through vaccination. Meanwhile, the virus is still spreading. In the United States, about 13% or so of people have so far been exposed. So we're about a fourth of the way to herd immunity, and the virus will keep spreading. So in about a year, we're going to reach herd immunity either artificially through vaccination or naturally through the spread of the virus. And that'll mark an important milestone where we have the biological and epidemiological impact of the virus behind us, but we still have a lot of way to go because we still have to respond to the social, economic, and psychological aftershocks of the pandemic.
The research you produce is only as good as the way you communicate it. Scientist Studio is an exciting science communication company that brings your research to life through a variety of services. From as little as £59, a summary of your work can be narrated, illustrated, and animated, leaving you with an engaging video to share with the world. If that wasn't enough, as a podcast listener, you can get 10% off any Scientist Studio service using the code PODCAST when you order. Simply head to our website or find us on Twitter to get started.
Herd immunity is such a brutal way for a pandemic to end, in my view. You know, when I think about herd immunity, I think of the death toll being extraordinarily high, which is why Boris Johnson was much criticized and had to deny that herd immunity was ever the tactic.
No, in fairness, I was not one of those people who thought it was crazy to consider herd immunity as an exit. In other words, it's not a crazy idea to have, but it is a crazy idea to enact once you start thinking about it in this situation for several reasons. First of all, in the modern era, we do have the capacity to invent vaccines. So postponing the epidemic until such time as we've invented a vaccine can avoid most of the death. There's no reason to go for herd immunity because actually we have an alternative, which didn't exist in the past. Furthermore, I can see the argument. People say, well, if eventually we're going to reach herd immunity, why not just get it over with? But even that argument doesn't hold water because if you're going to get 100,000 people in your country sick with a condition, it makes all the difference in the world if all 100,000 get sick this month versus 10,000 get sick every month for 10 months. In the latter case, your healthcare system can do its job normally to care for the sick and reduce the toll of death. Whereas if 100,000 people get sick this month, you have more death than you otherwise needed. So thinking about it is not a crazy, but after you do the calculations and think it through, in this case, I don't think that was a wise idea.
No, and actually, I love that distinction between considering something and enacting it, because it leads quite neatly into something else that you're extremely passionate about, which is the freedom of speech as a liberal commitment. And this is actually a very good example. I was someone who, perhaps having just had this conversation with you, was too quick to criticize Boris Johnson on the basis of he was considering this thing that he didn't follow through with. And in fact, the fact that this is a great demonstration, the fact that he was thinking about it means we're talking about it, which has meant that I've learned something. Is that sort of the backbone of how you see freedom of speech as a liberal commitment?
Yes, yes. It's a mark of an educated mind to be able to consider an idea without holding it, right? I mean, you know, you can think about something and it is not, you know, we don't need to prohibit you. We don't need thought police that stop you from thinking things or saying things. We want to foster a free and wide and open exchange of ideas. That's how we discover truth and falsehood. So I'm totally committed to the whole J.S. Mills project, that famous saying, you know, he who knows only his side of the case knows little of it, right? If you only know your arguments and you don't know the arguments of people who oppose you, you really don't understand what you're saying. And in order to be able to understand what you're saying, you need people to articulate the weaknesses in your argument or opposition. And in fact, this is actually why I trained in Shotokan karate for many years. You know, why do you bow to your opponent? You're grateful to your opponent. You bow before the match, you bow after the match, because it's through the interaction with your opponent that you learn and you become better. It's this kind of reverence for the clash that's so important. Now, of course, in my style of karate that I used to do, we were told never, you know, that the whole point of karate is avoiding conflict, which I think is a great wisdom, actually. But anyway, so that's the same with ideas, right? I mean, if you're so confident in the merit of your ideas, win the battle of ideas. Engage the people who disagree with you. Don't silence them. Don't try to stop them from expressing their ideas. That's weak, right? If you're trying to silence people, it means your ideas are weak, okay? And so this is why, you know, for example, in the herd immunity example, we could raise the example. Someone says, well, you know, we should consider herd immunity, I think. And other people say, no, actually, here's why it's a bad idea. And then the first person, well, actually, you're wrong. And, you know, we have a discussion about it. And then we hopefully reach a better understanding of the truth. At least that's how I see things.
Yeah, that's a brilliant characterization. I'm glad you brought up the karate. I want to talk to you actually a little bit about that in a moment, and particularly Master Kazumi Tabata.
You're too young to know Tabata.
Well, you know, I do my research.
He's still alive. He's an amazing human being.
So I want to talk a little bit about that because I think it's a brilliant story. But I want to just say, number one, that's a brilliant characterization of freedom of speech there. But the question I have of that, and this is sort of the utilitarian view, or I guess the Bentham utilitarian view versus the Mill utilitarian view, is how far do you take it when it comes to sort of fostering violence, et cetera, et cetera? Now, legally speaking, you can't do that, right? That isn't something that you're legally allowed to do.
No, I think this is a very silly and slippery slope. Your words are not your actions. Now, then you get into the sophist argument where people say, well, you're physically moving your mouth and speech is an action. And that, you know, no. The colloquial understanding of the difference between what I say to you and if I touch you, you know, we can draw that distinction. And so I think there shouldn't be anything that's off limits to say. And in fact, I think that the use of words instead of actions is, of course, a mark of civilization. Instead of killing you or fighting you, I talk to you. You know, maybe I say awful things to you. You know, maybe I say things you don't want to hear, but that's vastly better than the alternatives. I don't want listeners to misunderstand. There's actually a lot of complexity here, and there are some gray areas, and there are some edge cases which are hard. But generally speaking, I do not subscribe to the belief that speech is violence. I don't want to grant that. Now, speech can be used to foster violence, right? You can whip up anti-Semitism, or you can whip up racism, or, you know, for example, in Rwanda, during the Rwandan genocide, right? There was a tremendous amount of genocidal hatred that was whipped up by actors there. But there is, in fact, still, even there, a difference between the statements and the actions. And I think we absolutely can, as a society, pass rules or denounce or stop actions, but I don't think we should stop speech.
It's a very good distinction, and Rwanda serves as a brilliant example, because I tend to agree with you that the speech is physically action is a nonsense type of argument and is kind of intellectually dishonest. And I feel that quite strongly. On the other hand, though, when there's a strong link, and it's obviously difficult to prove a strong link, but if you look at Rwanda, you could try, I guess, and make the connection between those words being spoken and the outbreak of violence. Well, now it's not that the speech is violence, but you might make some utilitarian case. And you could make the opposite too, which is to say to not allow the speech ends in worse outcomes. But nonetheless, you're left with a slightly prickly problem of the speech has led to the violence.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm not saying that speech plays no role in violence. Of course it does. I'm just saying there's a difference between speech and violence, and we should think carefully before we regulate speech, because there's a very short hop. And incidentally, the protection of free expression is ordinarily seen as a protection on minority groups. Here, I don't mean ethno-racial minorities. I mean people who hold minority beliefs in a population. The majority doesn't need free speech protections. It has the ballot box or the gun to impose its will. So to the extent that we support free and wide expression, we're actually, what we're really doing is fostering the ability of people who hold minority views to be heard. That's one of the reasons why we do this. And so, you know, I think that we should be very wary of trying to regulate what people can say. And typically this power is used by majority groups to silence minority groups, to prevent them from expressing themselves. And there's no one to whom I wish to grant the power to regulate what I say. Honestly, I don't trust anyone else to decide what Nicholas can or cannot say. And I think most human beings would agree with that.
Yeah, I love that example. Because one thing that happens when you regulate speech, even though it's useful when you're faced with the philosophical dilemma of, oh, well, what about that case over there where speech led to violence, is you end up with side effects, you end up with trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs that you've so eloquently kind of presented is, well, what happens is minority groups now lose their protections. Mill would probably say something like, well, paternalism is bad here and has a negative utility attached. So even though it's great in that specific example not to have that man say that thing that led to violence in that case, as soon as you start regulating speech with any consistency...
Yes, you get book burning and the destruction of museums. That's what happens. I mean, I'm seeing that even in the United States right now. I mean, there are many, many exhibits. Actually, fascinating cases where, for instance, anti-racist left-wing artists who produced works that were clearly critical of racism in the United States are now seen as potentially racist and threatening. And then the museums are trying to take down the shows. It was an incredible case in Cleveland of an African-American artist that did paintings of police brutality. Actually, they were sketches, I think. I can't remember if they were paintings or sketches in this case. And people protested his show. And so the museum pulled the show. And the artist is like, what are you talking about? You know, just convoluted crap, right? Like, let me just also be clear about this. There's no right to have your work appear in a museum. There's no right to speak on a university campus. But once the show is mounted or once the speaker is invited, we should never yield to mobs that say, take it down, right? Those institutions of universities and museums, their whole point is to support artistic and intellectual and free and open exchange. If we start taking shows down and restricting what people can see or say because some group doesn't want to allow it, we're cutting at the root of those crucial institutions. Anyway, there have been a whole spate of these cases in the United States in the last couple of years. I think the Tate Modern was drawn into this. A painter who I'm blocking on his name right now did all of these paintings of the Klan, of the Ku Klux Klan, where he was clearly criticizing the Klan. I mean, you know, these were seen as very threatening paintings and the show was canceled. It was to be a show, a retrospective show in the National Gallery and various elite museums around the world, and the show was pulled. I think that was wrong.
Yeah, those details are fucking mental. I mean, I broadly am on the left, but the left eats itself. You know, you get civil rights heroes, professors, yes, shouted out of classrooms for wearing a t-shirt that has the word lit on it because the etymology of lit isn't... I mean, no, it's mental. And like, I think a lot of people on the left are frustrated.
I'm not familiar with that case you mentioned. What was the case? Someone was wearing a t-shirt that said what?
The word lit. Lit as in cool, good.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that case now, yes.
And universities are interesting, right? Because they should be the bastion, the unique bastion of free speech, etc. But equally, you know, they're academic institutions and academics tend to lean left. And it's a shame, again, as someone broadly on the left, that the left here means slightly repressive, slightly over-regulatory. How do you see universities, and I'm aware that we've just got a couple of minutes here, but how do you see universities and their role in this quite strange situation?
I'm concerned still about universities in these regards. Now, often, but not always, these brouhahas have to do with issues of race and sex and colonialism. And usually the threats, the calls to shut down speech from within universities come from the left, but from outside universities come from the right. So there have also been a spate of cases where, for example, professors have said, you know, defund the police or police are racist or stuff like that, sometimes correctly so, right? And then right-wing legislators have said, you know, fire the professor, you know. So there are a number of threats, you know, the open society and its enemies, you know, there are a number of threats to free and open expression from different directions. But within universities, I think it's definitely coming from the left primarily at most universities. And I think that's, you know, really wrong. You know, I think that we should be protecting this institution. And if you don't like what someone is saying, you don't have to listen to them. You can protest them. You can argue with them. You can bring your best ideas, your best data, your best arguments and beat them at their own game. But you absolutely should not silence them. And you shouldn't silence them, not just because it's in their right, in their interest to speak, not even so much because it's in the interest of the listeners. Let's not forget, when you silence a speaker, either because you disinvite them or because you shout them down in a way that makes it so they can't be heard, the rights you're infringing are on your fellow students who want to hear that speaker. It's not just the speaker's right, it's the listener's right is being infringed. And finally, even you're harming even yourself a little bit. Because if you actually listen to the speaker, you could say, you know, this guy is full of crap. I don't agree with him. I listened to him for an hour and he's making no sense at all. And I disagree still. I haven't changed my mind. Or you might say, you know, I changed my mind 5%. You know, I used to be very extreme about this and now I'm not quite as extreme. You've learned something, you know, from this guy, or not maybe from this guy, but because of this guy. So I just think that administrators need to stiffen their spines and defend free expression. And when there's a brouhaha of any kind about any topic, and a group is saying this speaker should be silenced or fired, the answer needs to be uniformly, we do not silence or fire people on this campus for things they say. If it's something they do, then we'll think about it. But for what they say, we just don't do it, period. Stop asking for that. You're not going to get it.
Nicholas, thank you so much for this. This has been brilliant.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me.
No, so everyone, that has been the most fascinating episode of the Scientist Podcast. I hope you agree. And we thank Nicholas for coming on. And as always, we'll see you next week.